All right, welcome back to Bookkeeping Buds Loan Talk with Nancy, take two. So there were some questions from the calls earlier that we didn't get to, so I just thought it would be easier to jump back on a call with her to go through these questions. So the first question we have was, many clients are already laid off staff prior to the application, so application has last year's numbers. Current numbers are a quarter of that for employees. How many can be forgiven if we only have between a quarter and a half employees rehired with slow economy?
Okay, so I'm actually really glad that this question got answered, because I alluded to this earlier, you know, when we were speaking earlier, and said I would come back to it, and then forgot to come back to it. So first and foremost, I want to explain how this calculation is supposed to work, and then we'll talk about the challenges in terms of real life of getting this to actually happen. So yes, the application is based on last year's numbers. And the person who asked this question is pointing out that, well, with a slow economy, current numbers are like a quarter to a half of that for employees. Well, yes, that's the whole point for Paycheck Protection Program. They don't want you to only have a quarter to half your employees. They want you to have 75% to 100% of your employees. So it, from the perspective of the PPP, it doesn't care. It's saying, look, we're gonna give you enough money to support your payroll at 75% to 100% of what it was average a year ago, or over the course of the past year. And so when you're doing the calculations, that doesn't mean if you don't hire all your employees back, you won't get any of it forgiven. As I mentioned earlier, there's a phase out. It's not a cliff. You will be able to run a calculation, which I should put in one of the blog posts. Nobody's had to use it yet. Nobody's put it to the test yet. But there is a calculation that was released, not in subsequent guidance, but in the original CARES Act when the PPP was created. So there is a phase out, and it's basically like, oh, well, if you have 75% or more of your FTE, your full-time equivalent employee hours, and 75% of your pay of your average from last year or the prior 12 months, then you will have it all forgiven. If you only have 70%, then you'll have slightly less forgiven. If you have 65%, 60, et cetera, et cetera. And it phases out at, I don't remember what the number is. That we can look that one up. That's an easy one. Here's the problem though. The problem is you may not have enough work for keeping your staff at 75% of your average from last year. And this is a real problem. You can pay them to do nothing, of course. You can come up with new things for them to do, such as helping you pivot your business to do something different. To, let's say that you used to do in-person consulting, maybe they can help you get set up so that you can do podcasts or Zoom meetings, or, you know, some sort of non-in-person consulting work. Maybe they can help establish new sales channels. So if you used to be a dine-in restaurant, maybe they can help you figure out how to do takeout and delivery in an efficient and effective way. I've seen some very, very creative work among my clients and others out there, where people are having their employees brainstorm and research what other small businesses are doing, and doing things like pairing with other businesses that are in trouble. So a great example, one of my favorites, is I have a client who knows that they're a restaurant, and so they're only doing takeout and delivery. They're having their own people do the deliveries, the contactless deliveries, instead of hiring Grubhub or Caviar. They are minimizing it, the amount of time that the staff are spending in the kitchen together, so that they can social distance properly, by taking orders by 6 p.m. one day and then delivering those orders for the next day's dinner window, so that they can have different people on different shifts in the kitchen instead of people working together. And most creatively, I thought, They looked at their vendors who are also independent small businesses who were selling them things like coffee and eggs and sourdough starter, and said, hey, can you keep supplying us with these things and we'll put them on our website for purchase as groceries for our restaurant clients. So when you order your dinner for the next night, you can order some of these groceries from their vendors, and that keeps the vendors having a stream of income, right? So pairing with other small businesses and figuring out these creative ideas. So that is actually one thing that you could do to get those hours of your employees up to that three quarters, that 75%, is actually hire your employees to help you figure out how to increase your sales. Have them do social media marketing for you. I know that I would have to hire somebody to do my Instagram stories for me because I cannot figure that stuff out. You know, hire somebody younger and cooler than yourself to do that kind of stuff. So that's one option. But I think where we're really going to see the problem and where doing this in real life is a serious challenge. I'm going to give you an example of one of my favorite clients. She runs a cafe. She runs a cafe on the campus of a university. The university's closed. Even if she could open the cafe and do takeout and delivery, there's nobody there to order stuff. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever to be open. They also don't have a bunch of things, and it's really about the camaraderie of the place. You know, they also are a not-for-profit bookstore that's housed in their place, and it's not a, you know, the food that they would be able to sell takeout delivery, it wouldn't be enough to keep them going. So she applies for PPP. She's so excited. She was my like second client, I think, that got approved. We were doing a little dance over text, so excited. And then she finds out with this new guidance that came out Thursday night that, as I said earlier in the call, it's 10 days from approval to disbursement. Not signing, 10 days from approval to disbursement. And then that 8 weeks begins on the day of disbursement. Well, she wasn't planning on, I mean, she's in Chicago. There's still a stay-at-home order. The university is still closed. She wasn't planning on opening up when she gets this funding later this week. She was going to hold on to it and wait until the stay-at-home order is lifted, the university opens back up, and she can bring all of her staff back and really jumpstart with this 8 weeks. Well, now we're talking about the 8 weeks starting on date of disbursement. And I thought before that we'd be able to just apply for these things, have people wait to sign until they're ready, and then it would be 10 days from signing, and that didn't happen. So this is actually a real world problem that this question addresses here. And I do not know the answer, but it is my number one priority over the course of the next few days is to come up with some creative ideas about how to deal with that kind of situation. If anybody has ideas about it, please reach out to me. I would love to hear them. I have some ideas myself. I don't know how legal they are. But this is a great example of like, okay, here's this awesome program, but are the people who need it the most going to be able to use it in the way that they need to? And in my group of clients, the industry that's hardest hit by that are the cafes, even worse so than restaurants and retail. Of course, they've got their issues as well. What they really need is for this 8 weeks to start as late as possible, basically. Yeah. So great question. And the answer is sort of, I don't know.
Yeah, because wasn't there was something that with a date of like June 30th kept coming up, was that yes. to pay the loan, starting paying the loan back, or I don't even remember.
No, I know what you're talking about. I've actually heard this in two different webinars, and one of them was Tony Nitti, who is my number one favorite tax writer. He's with, he writes for Forbes, and I took his webinar, and I took another one by a little prominent speaker. I'm trying to remember who it was right now. And they both alluded to something where if you've got all of your employees hired back by 6:30, you know, by June 30th, then you can get forgiveness. And I cannot figure out if this is an exception or if this is a different interpretation, or if they're saying, hey, just hold on to the money. Don't hire people back until, you know, June 29th and then give them 8 weeks of pay all at once. I don't really know what they're saying there, but that actually is that's the main thing that I'm trying to figure out. I keep hearing this being alluded to, and I don't know what it represents. It's not in the actual regs. It does not explain it. But my guess is that these are, these are both analysts that are probably looking at the regs and thinking, oh, well, you could do it this way. Again, if anybody has got more insight on this than I do, or who has heard something that sounds too good to be true, please reach out to me, because I'm investigating all the too good to be trues right now to see how much truth there is behind them. The short answer to the question is, you know, it phases out if you go below 75%. The long answer to the question is, we don't know. We'll see. It depends. It's a real problem.
Yeah. We have one of our bigger clients is a salon, and they have 25 employees. That's so they had a lot of small go, you know, obviously. And I mean, they filed, but if they get it, I mean, they can't open
up. What are they going to do with it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they really need. And the thing is, I do feel like this is enough small businesses that are going to be in that situation that at some point this is going to have to be addressed. Guidance.
Sure.
But I need to know the answer now, because this is going to get funded in the next few days, and we don't have those answers. It's pretty frustrating.
All right. So the next one is, so this is from Alice. She said she decided to try the link through QBO to activate their linked service and get my own application going. This is for the PPP. Mm-hmm. They said they would let me know. Oh, she's just asking if anyone else tried this path. So
I would love to hear if anybody else has. I mean, what she's talking about, for anybody who's listening to this later on, who doesn't understand that question. There are a lot of companies that are not traditional banks that are working with banks in partnership and are connecting people. So QBO, obviously one of them. Cindy announced that Square was going to be doing this. Gusto has partners. We've had some Divi. People on Bookkeeping Buds that have had success with Divi. That seems to be the best one so far. Really impressive. I haven't tried this one, but that is exactly what happened to me with Chase when I applied. I got my application going, but I didn't, I'm just waiting to hear back. This seems to be, there's an extra step with QBO. You have to activate their linked service and then they let you know. Have you heard about this? They let you know, like, whether or not you.
Yeah, I mean, at first they had said they were going to do something like that, and then I think they decided not to. Like, the reason they were going to do this linked service was because they knew, I think it was last Wednesday or whatever, they were trying to get that out first and knowing that the full product's not going to be ready yet. And they decided they were just going to wait until the full product.
But they didn't want to lose the business. So they were trying to, I see. Well, if anybody in Buds has tried that, reach out to Cindy and let them know what your success has been so that she can let other people know.
And this kind of goes along with another question, which is later, but what about applying for two banks if your application seems stuck? Is that allowed?
I'm so glad somebody asked that. So this has been going around and around and around in circles from the beginning. So at first the advice was, yes, you can go with more than one bank, apply at more than one bank at the same time. But do you really want to? You know, it should be all about having a good relationship with your banker. And I heard that and I was like, you know what? Yeah, if you have a good relationship with your banker and you feel confident about that, go for it. But my banker is a screen. I have no banker. You know, I do something, it disappears into a void. Maybe I'll hear back someday. Like, I have no personal banker. So in that kind of situation, I was telling people and hearing back from some of my clients who were, you know, more successful, that you should just apply with everybody you can apply with. If you have the time on your hands, go for it and see who either has the, at the time that we were recommending this, the guidance was all over the place. I mean, there was no there were so many things that we had questions about. So it was like, okay, well, whichever bank is going to let you calculate the highest amount, go with them, or whichever one can process it the fastest, go with them. And then all of a sudden we heard back that a lot of banks were saying, no, if you're applying with us, you can't apply with anybody else. And a congressman that I took a webinar from the other day said that that was simply not part of the legislation, and those were banks making up their own rules, and that was not cool. And so we went back to saying, well, you know, depends on how confident you feel that you're going to get it through your bank. If you don't feel confident, go elsewhere and don't worry about the fact that it might mess up your application with the other bank. They certainly aren't checking with each other to see if you've already got another loan going. So my recommendation at this point is go with whomever. I mean, somebody on BUD said earlier that they had applied with Bank of America and Bank of America was giving them the runaround, and then they applied with Divvy and got in immediately. And she's like, you know what? If Bank of America gets back in touch with me, I'm going to say, you lost your chance. You just lost your 5%. Because the banks are doing a lot of work. I have a friend who's high up at Bank of America, and she's just been overwhelmed with the amount of work that she's doing. You know, they're getting new guidance every day. They then have to communicate that guidance to their bankers, and those bankers are already overwhelmed with all of these, processing all of these loans. They don't have 3 hours of continuing education per day, like time to do that. So it's understandable that not all bankers are on the same level. And so if you find one that is working better than another, just go with them, and whoever funds it first or best. That's what I say. Recognizing that you might be putting one of these in jeopardy because you might have a bank that's a real stickler. But that is not part of the act. That is banks making up their own rules.
Excellent. All right. Then we have, are you guys advising your smaller S-Corp clients that have maybe one or two employees to try for PPP, even if they are still doing business on a reduced level?
Yes. Yes. The answer is yes. I am advising, I don't want to say everybody to do PPP. I am advising any organization that can, there's the conversation we just had about how difficult it is timing wise, right? Like you don't want to get the money now and then not, you know, and but it's later that you want to reopen. You want to wait until the last possible minute to reopen because the stay-at-home orders haven't lifted yet. But as long as you're not in that situation, there's no amount that is too small. And I was advising an attendee for one of my Zoom Q&A sessions last week. She said, she talked to her accountant, she's an S-Corp, it's just her. Business is on a reduced level. She said, well, I talked to my accountant said it wasn't worth it to apply for PPP. And I said, okay, let's say that your W-2 for the year was $1,200, okay? And you divide that by 12, that's $100 a month, times 2.5 is $250. You're doing business on a reduced level, and you're bored and you're frustrated, and this application only takes like 20 minutes. Would you take 20 minutes out of your day to apply for $250? I would right now. Right. If I had 20 minutes and somebody wanted to give me $250 for that 20 minutes, you can bet your booty I would apply. So there's no amount that is too small to apply for, in my opinion. So a smaller S-Corp client that only has one or two employees, as long as there's work for those employees to be doing, and it's not like a situation where we're talking about with that cafe that's closed and she really can't warrant bringing them off of unemployment to do nothing for her when she really needs that money for later when she's jump-starting the business. With the exception of that kind of situation, I would say really everybody should be applying for PPP. Your alternative, however, is the employment tax, the payroll tax credit up to $5,000 per employee that is mutually exclusive to the PPP. If that is something that you qualify for, you might want to just run the numbers on both. There's a really good article that I sent out to Debbie Murphy after our call earlier today that basically is like, hey, how do those two programs interact and how do I choose which one to do? And I think running the numbers is advisable. But I can't think of many situations where the PPP would not be worth applying for.
And that brings us to our next question, which is from Debbie, which is probably the one she sent you. Do you know how the payroll tax payment extension will work for employers? Is there somewhere they need to apply for it?
Yes. I don't know how the deferral works, which is her question. She calls it a payroll tax payment extension on this question, but what she's talking about there is the payroll tax deferral. I don't know how that's going to work, but all of my clients go through Gusto or ADP, and Gusto and ADP have both already said that they will take care of that. So that's something that you need to talk to them about. It's a little bit challenging because both Gusto and ADP take out all of the money at once, and then they send it to the agencies when it's due. So this is going to be really hard for them. Because if you're deferring payment of the payroll taxes, then they're not, their system, which is already in place to be able to direct debit all of this on the day of payroll, or you know, a few days before payroll, whatever, that's gonna be hard. They're gonna have to figure out some way to not pull all of it out of your bank account, right? Because you don't want them to pull it out and then defer it being paid to the agencies and just sit in Gusto's or ADP's bank account. Right. So in a situation where you're working with a payroll company, I would reach out to them and see how the mechanics are going to work. And as far as doing payroll through QuickBooks, I hate QuickBooks payroll and refuse to use it. So you'd have to talk to some of the other buds about that. What I can answer is a slightly different question, which is how the payroll tax credit is going to work. The, oh my gosh, it's like that EIEIO. One that you put in the invitation, Cindy, it's got some acronym, EIT something. So this is the payroll tax credit that is, they call it 50% per employee up to $10,000. So for in most situations, it's going to be $5,000 per employee. And that is going to work by not paying in. It's going to work, I believe, the same way that the sick pay is going to work, which we didn't talk about today. If you are running your business and people have to take sick leave, and then after that, potentially Family Medical Leave Act, that those are things that you can get reimbursed for by the federal government. And in that situation and in the employment tax credit situation, you actually can just reduce the amount of tax deposits that you're making. And you get to keep that money. So instead of collecting all of the taxes from payroll and then sending them off to the payroll company or having payroll company direct debit them, you will keep those in your account and never have to make those payroll tax payments. And then in the situation where the payroll tax deposits are not sufficient, there's a form 7200 where you'll actually apply for the balance of it and get that given back to you in the form of a direct deposit or a check. So those are all payroll related programs, whether it's the sick pay, the Family Medical Leave Act, the payroll tax credit, and the payroll tax deferral. All four of those are payroll oriented programs, not just the Paycheck Protection Program. I'm talking about through payroll itself. And so I would get in touch with, I haven't done as much research on those things because they're being, I mean, I know how they work conceptually, but they're being processed through your payroll companies. So reach out to your payroll company and say, I'm interested in these things. And I want to give a sort of plug for Gusto here and just say, their reps have been amazing. Their blog posts have been amazing. They have a section of their website where they've just collected by state every single thing that they can possibly find as far as relief is concerned. It's a great resource. I have gotten a lot out of it and out of their blog posts, and they've just been doing everything they can. they already were my favorite payroll company, but if we come out of this on the other side, I might just tell clients it's a requirement to go with Gusto, because they have made, they put me in a situation where I can help more clients because they're taking care of some of the heavy lifting on this stuff.
Agreed. We're moving all our clients to Gusto. Like, anybody new that comes for payroll, we're like, you have to use Gusto. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, anybody new who comes in, we've been doing that for a while, but I think I might, I might twist a few clients' arms who are still clinging to old systems.
Awesome. Okay. So this question is, could you please clarify what, if any, programs will assist bookkeeping firms with loss of client work, consulting income, or the client put a work stop in place for some period of time versus the PPP for employee payroll or paychecks?
So this is a great, great, great example of what I was talking about earlier when I said, you know, dollar for dollar, the United States is doing just as much, if not more, as other countries for their citizens. But in terms of the safety net not existing prior to this, they have no way to get that income to people, right? Except for these arduous things like the PPP and the EIDL and these four different payroll-related things that we just discussed, and state bridge loans and independent grants. And it's all really messy. It's all really difficult. And I'm especially concerned on behalf of the people who don't have a bookkeeper or accountant or CPA or lawyer on their side. I'm concerned for people who don't have computers and don't have the ability to do this. There are a lot of small businesses that, you know, people are just using their phones for this kind of stuff. And they're not necessarily able to just jump on a Zoom call. And they don't necessarily have access to internet. And the libraries are closed, right? So we're failing our citizens with the fact that this money is there and it's hard for them to get to. And this question is asking, how are we going to assist firms with loss of client work? They're not. When you run out of work or when your hours dip low, you're going to have to go on unemployment. And most states' unemployment systems are not yet set up. Even though I have a mandate from the federal government to cover self-employed people, most of the systems are not set up to be able to do that. They don't have the training on how to review tax returns because they've always been looking at W-2s and pay stubs. Their physical systems are written in, I'm trying to remember what, like an ancient computer language. It's like Fortran or COBOL or something horrible like that. IBM is actually giving free classes to people to learn these languages so that they can help reprogram state unemployment systems. That's how old and bad these are, right? So they don't have the computer systems to be able to accept documents that aren't the things that they've already been requesting for years. They don't have the people trained to be able to do it. They have an unbelievable backlog of people who are applying for unemployment who aren't self-employed, like, you know, regular W-2 employees, and not enough people because they've never set up their systems to be able to have these people working remotely. So these people are coming into the office, they're, you know, which is a dangerous situation, not enough social distancing. They are overwhelmed and they don't have proper training. I mean, the federal government just said, they gave them a mandate and said, you have to do this, but gave them no resources with which to do it. And so if you are self-employed and you do go try to collect unemployment right now, at least in Illinois, and I know in a lot of other states, it says, please hang tight. We can't help you right now, which is just horrible. And I understand that people are really mad about that, but think about the situation that these offices are in. There's really no way they can help you. The safety net didn't exist prior to this. So what program is going to assist with loss of client work? Unemployment is what's going to assist with loss of client work. If you don't have revenue coming in and you can't pay yourself and you can't pay staff, then now most states are allowing people to claim partial unemployment. If you just had a reduction in work hours or a reduction in revenue, and you can substantiate that, they are letting that happen. So for W-2 employees, so let's say, you know, you're a full-time employee and now you're only a quarter-time employee, you can collect a portion of unemployment for the part that you're, which was not always the case. When is this going to happen for self-employed people? I don't know. I mean, look at the situation that they're in. So I don't think we're going to see any situation. I don't think we're going to see any program that's going to assist bookkeeping firms with the loss of client work or consulting income, or the client put a work stop in place. You're going to have to eventually claim unemployment for your reduced income. They're the stimulus checks that are going to be coming. PPP is not really an option there. If you're going to be able to pay people, but what are you going to pay them to do? I don't know. That's a tough situation. It's pretty heartbreaking.
All right. And I think this one we might have covered earlier. I think when they were talking about the PPP was not allowed to include owner's guaranteed payments in calculation. And I think we did talk about that one earlier.
Yeah, I think we talked about the fact that they should be included in the calculation. And I have that blog post that explains exactly how to do it. What this person seems to be saying is that they applied and they weren't allowed to include it. And that's a banker mistake. Okay. I'm seeing it a lot. A lot of bankers don't know how this is supposed to work. As I said, they're getting guidance. I mean, I think about how many hours a day I'm putting into this, right? If I were putting that many hours into this and I didn't have staff, I simply would not be doing any work. It's too many hours in a day. So here you've got bankers who are trying to process all these loans, taking time out to now understand this new guidance. And now 3 days later, there's new guidance. And there's 3 days later, there's new guidance. It's understandable that these bankers.
And that kind of leads to the other question. So what if the amount is calculated incorrectly? I mean, are they going to come back and say, this number, you know, we gave you way too much money now?
No. Actually, so this is really interesting. So the banks, one of the pieces of guidance that came out is that the banks are not required to do full normal due diligence on these numbers. They have to review them and make sure they're not insane. And they have to make sure that they're getting the supporting documentation, but they are not checking your math. And they are not, and that is one of the reasons in one of my recent blog posts, I think it was in the partner one, that is one of the reasons that I'm like, you know what, you can do your banker a favor by being organized, knowing what the rules are, coming up with your calculations and showing your work like you used to in math class when you were young. Show your work, show them how the calculation was done, explain what the rules are basically, you know, if they don't know them. You really can do them a favor. So if you accidentally asked for too much, but you asked for too much according to the old rules that were in place, then the SBA and Treasury have said, whatever the rules were at that point in time, however you applied for it then, if it's already been processed, don't worry about it. But that also means that there are going to be a lot of people who didn't ask for enough because they pulled all of that federal withholding and employee portion of Social Security and Medicare out. So they didn't ask for enough. Well, it's also too bad for them. Whatever the rules were at the time and however it was interpreted by the banker and yourself, that's what you're stuck with. Now, if you make a mistake and your loan has not been approved yet, you are supposed to be allowed to work with your banker to resubmit the information based on new guidance. If it's already been approved, too bad. If it hasn't been approved yet, then you're still supposed to have an opportunity to go back in. And last point about that is, if your overcalculation was not consistent with regulations at the time and you request too much, you're the one signing it. They actually removed the lender signature in the second go around of guidance on that application form. They removed the lender signature. Lender's not certifying any. You are. If you mess it up, you're legally on the line for potentially having to pay that back or not having it forgiven, not the lender. So don't abuse this. If you make an honest mistake, that's one thing. But don't abuse it. And if you make an honest mistake and you catch it before the loan has been approved, let your banker know, because they are supposed to go back in and fix that.
And then, so this kind of plays off of that. So the forgiveness part of it. So if you're a partnership, and so you're just taking draws, and you use that number, right, for the PPP. I mean, do you have to prove something that for the forgiven part, or is it as long as you're paying yourself what you've always paid yourself? You said something earlier about some people might need a raise or.
Yeah. This one's really difficult because we thought that that guidance, and when I say we, I mean, like literally everybody thought, sure, including the commissioner of the 10th district in Chicago, blatantly said to the district rep for the district director for the SBA on a webinar that they were in together. She said, so, this was before April 10th when it was supposed to open up for the PPP program, was supposed to open up for self-employed people. So, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, of course we're going to be seeing guidance by, you know, sometime before the 10th, you know, presumably at least the night of the 9th, right? And he dodged that one. So here it is. I don't even know what today is, the 13th or something like that. 13th. And we still don't have guidance on that. So we know those two blog posts that I recently posted, the how to calculate it for self-employment and how to calculate it for a partner. We have a pretty good idea about how that should work. Banks don't always agree with us, but I think it was a pretty good idea of how it should work. The forgiveness, however, okay, if the calculation for the how much you're going to get funded is based on your net income, your net self-employment income from last year divided by 12 times 2.5, well, you can't. How are you going to calculate? You can't use that same calculation for forgiveness because you don't have your net income for 2020 yet.
Right.
So the only thing you can go on is draws. So for how is forgiveness going to be calculated for that? I have no freaking idea, but the only way I can imagine they're going to be able to do it when the guidance does finally come. I think this is why the guidance hasn't come out yet. They're like, I don't know either. So I would say if you could, your best bet is going to be to pay yourself, you know, take the amount that you applied for, divide it among, you know, the number of people who work there, if you've got staff, you know, plus yourself, if there's another partner in your business, whatever, divide it out in an equitable way, and then just pay people that much every week or give them that much at the, you know, at the end of the weeks or whatever, you know, do something to show, because you're going to have to show your work when this is all over. Otherwise, they wouldn't give you a 60-day period to be able to substantiate the forgiveness. Right, they're anticipating that you're going to need some time to substantiate that, to show your support, to show your work. And draws is the only way you're going to be able to show that. I mean, we don't
really well, and then they anything. And then they say, you know, like the 8 weeks or whatever. So if you take a draw at the end of the month, so are you supposed to do like a half month in there? Like, you know.
You know, you're bringing up all sorts of great questions that I don't know the answer to.
The other question I have.
You could, in theory, pay a lump sum bonus at the beginning or end of it, and it would still be 8 weeks worth, right?
Right.
Well, and I don't think they're likely to look at each week. I think what you're probably going to end up doing is saying, during the course of 8 weeks, here's the payroll I paid out, here's substantiation for that. During that course of that 8 weeks, here are the draws that I paid out. Here's substantiation for that. And here's the rent and utilities that I paid out. And here's the substantiation for that. Of course, benefits actually are going to be in there as well, as that's part of payroll. So you're going to need substantiation for that. So again, it's why tracking this as a sub-account of a bank or with a separate class or opening a separate bank account, these are all really good ways to be able to say, look, during this 8-week period, here are my totals. I don't think they're going to ask, was this paid evenly over that 8-week period? Seems like that would just not be worth their time and effort.
Sure.
I can't say what it's going to look like. That's my guess.
Sure. And then the question was, you had said that for the forgiveness part, 75% of it has to go for payroll. Does that include the payroll taxes?
It does not include employer payroll taxes. I should say this differently. It does not include federal employer payroll taxes. It does include at least the calculation for getting the loan. So hopefully the calculation for forgiveness as well is going to include payroll, or we're postulating draws if it's self-employed or partner, sole proprietor or partner. Then it's going to include benefits, and those benefits would be health insurance, 401k, sick pay, and I'm sure there are some others, but those are the big ones. And it's going to include state payroll taxes, which for most states are only, or state, the employer side of state payroll taxes, which for most states is just unemployment. So it's going to include that. So when you say, does it include payroll taxes to get to that 75%? No, but all those other things are included.
Okay.
So you're not just talking about the pay that's going out the door. The state payroll tax isn't going to get you very far, but those benefits might. I mean, I don't know about you, but the amount that I pay for health insurance on behalf of my employees is, you know, pretty good. And I'm glad that that's getting included here. I wish I had started a 401k plan a while back, but oh well.
All right. So then, are you hearing that one of the requirements, and this is for partnership guaranteed payments, are you hearing that one of the requirements is that guaranteed payments need to, I'm not sure what that means, need to, I guess it should be in the operating agreement?
Be in the operating agreement. Yeah. No, I'm not seeing that at all, because think about it. It doesn't matter. The operating agreement, as far as guaranteed payments is concerned, is really between the partners, right? That part of the operating agreement it's not really the IRS's business so much. They just need to make sure that you're following your own rules. And so there are plenty of partnerships that have sort of handshake agreements about how they're going to run their business. And they might say, oh, we're going to do everything 50-50 net income split, or they might have some. I have clients who have extremely complicated methods of calculating guaranteed payments versus your allocated net income to make it equitable for everybody. And so I don't think that having any of this outlined in the operating agreement, I think it's a good thing to have, because you're not likely to have huge arguments among the partners. If you do have it, I always encourage people to put as much in your operating agreement as you can about this kind of stuff, but then you have to follow it. And that's the other thing, is that there are plenty of operating agreements out there where somebody was like, oh, our lawyer said we needed this, so that's why we have it. And then I look at it when it's time to do their tax return, and I'm like, what? You haven't been doing this at all. I think ultimately, anybody who wants to make an argument that guaranteed payments plus net income shouldn't all be considered payroll for the purpose of the Paycheck Protection Program when partners are concerned, anybody who's arguing that they shouldn't all be included is just not thinking about what a paycheck is. A paycheck is something that you pay payroll taxes on. So why, like, it, whether or not you're using guaranteed payments, whether or not, to what extent, rather, you're using guaranteed payments versus using your splitting, you know, your ownership percentage of net income flow through and getting distributions on that. It's really kind of not their business. As long as you're following your agreement with yourself, it shouldn't be an issue here. I just don't see why it would be. And I'm not, I mean, nobody quote me, because of course, nobody quote me.
We already had the preface. No one sue Nancy.
Nobody sue me. This is my opinion. This is my opinion. This is my research. And this is how I think it should be. But I just think you have a darned good leg to stand on. If you're saying, look, the reason I chose this is that I pay self-employment taxes and therefore it is a replacement for payroll. I don't think it needs to be that. The operating agreements are across the board on this. I mean, I have so many clients in so many different situations as far as this is concerned. Some people only do, they don't do guaranteed payments at all. They only do net profit partially because it's a way to increase the Section 199 Cap A deduction, you know? And so last year, the people who were doing guaranteed payments, we said, oh, stop doing guaranteed payments, make everything be net income because it's better for Section 199A. And now we're like, oh, you can only do guaranteed payments instead of, you know, whatever. It's crazy. There's just, don't even get me started on tax policy in this country and how inconsistent it is. I don't think it needs to be in the operating agreement. I haven't seen any operating agreements requested so far. Use tax, if you can at all, use tax documents. If you don't have tax documents, you are allowed to use the P&L, as I mentioned earlier. But if you can use documents, tax documents, because bankers understand stuff that is formatted in a way that is consistent from entity to entity, right? Like every partnership has K-1s. Self-employment earnings are in box 14 of the K-1. They understand that number. Try to use that number. They understand what Schedule SE on a personal tax return is. Look at box 4, line 4, I mean, yeah.
Okay, two more questions. On a dental industry webinar this weekend, I heard dentists wondering if they could keep their staff on unemployment right up until the 8-week forgiveness period is about to end, then hire the staff back in mid-June, and then pay them a lump sum bonus amount. Is that reasonable? And
we kind of. I wonder if that's what we keep hearing about, the thing we were talking about earlier. I wonder if that's what we're hearing about. Like, you know, technically, could you get away with this? Yeah, I think so. Because, okay, is it in the spirit of the law? No. It is definitely not in the spirit of the law. But if you are in the situation that a dentist would be in and that a cafe would be in, where right now you're basically not allowed to be open, and except for emergencies in the case of a dentist and deliveries in the case of a cafe. But even if you were allowed to be open, who's going to go there right now? I wouldn't want to work on anybody's teeth. If I were a dental hygienist, and I wouldn't want to go in and have anybody putting their fingers in my mouth. I mean, that sounds like a terrible idea. I don't want to go hang out at a cafe right now. Even if these rules weren't in place, I don't want to do those things for my own safety and as a citizen that is trying to help with a public health crisis. So on the one hand, that's not in the spirit of this. And on the other hand, if you have no work for them and what you're trying to use the PPP for is to jumpstart this business once businesses are allowed to start opening again and once people are actually likely to start going again, this is probably the argument that we've been hearing, where you could keep them on unemployment and then hire the staff back in mid-June and give them a lump sum bonus amount. Is that reasonable? I think it's reasonable if you're in one of those industries in that very difficult situation. I don't think it's reasonable if you can pull them off of unemployment and have them help you pivot toward different offerings and different sales channels, because the economy needs your money now. The economy needs you to be producing now. The economy needs you to be paying people now. It's certainly not in the spirit of it if you're just taking advantage of the unemployment program and then you're taking advantage of the PPP. On the other hand, if it is really like the only way that you're gonna get your staff back up and working again without losing their jobs again in the next 8 weeks, yeah, I you know, again, don't quote me on this. This isn't legal advice, but it certainly seems reasonable to me. I think we're going to see, I'm going back to the same conversation we were having earlier. I think we're going to see people making this comment a lot and complaining about it a lot. And eventually they're going to have either some kind of guidance, or you're going to see the accounting and legal industries making their own decisions about what seems fair and reasonable. To me, for a dentist, that seems reasonable. For a cafe, that seems reasonable. For other businesses that are able to have their employees help them redefine themselves, I don't think it's reasonable.
Excellent. And the last question, and this didn't come up today, but it was on Slack, and I just wanted to get your opinion about it because I have a feeling that it might come up more. Mm-hmm. So there was a question about one of the bookkeepers who's been doing monthly work for a client is now asking for her to be put on payroll to take the biggest advantage of the PPP forgiveness. So can you just have your thoughts on that?
I would love to give you my thoughts on that, Cindy. Oh my God. So, number one, if that person qualifies as an employee, they should have been on payroll all along. Okay? They should have been on payroll all along. That's the biggest issue there. Do they qualify as an independent contractor, or do they qualify as an employee? The IRS has 9 different criteria. Put all those criteria on a piece of paper and write up, I tell this to all of my clients when they're not sure, copy and paste those 9 things from the IRS website and write up a paragraph for each one, whether it's a yes or a no. You don't have to get all 9. Look at the facts and circumstances, right? And if it's, you write up a paragraph and they say, yes, I think for this number 1, they count as an independent contractor. For number 2, they don't. For number 3, they do, et cetera, et cetera, and so on. And overwhelmingly, it's independent contractor. Well, then they should stay as an independent contractor. The question is not about whether or not they should do this to get the PPP. All right? So that's one thing. The other thing, which I think is just as important, is, look, everybody wants these dollars. Could you please play by the rules and the spirit of this? If your business is hurting, then you apply for the PPP to try to help you. And if it's helping you, it's supposed to be helping your employees. You're paying your employees to help you keep the business going. Hire back the employees that you have lost. Don't try to convert somebody who's an independent contractor into an employee. You may legally get away with it, but it is so not kosher. Totally not kosher. Yeah, there's one more question on this screen here that I feel like I want to address. It's the very, very bottom there. What if a business applies, gets the loan, and can't prove that it was a detriment to their business? That one's a really easy one to answer. Is that when you get the loan, you're checking a box saying, I certify that this has been a problem, right? And this is for the EIDL that they're talking about. I certify that this has impacted me. And if it turns out it didn't impact you, you shouldn't have been applying for the loan in the first place. They're not going to ask you after the fact to prove that it was a detriment to your business. They're asking you when you apply. So don't apply if you don't need it. And actually, I had a situation with a church that was thinking about applying for PPP. And the church actually has they've been doing their services online, and they've been getting just as much donations, tithing, whatever you call it, as usual, if not more so. Yeah, which is just wonderful. I mean, that makes me feel happy about humans. Not a lot of things don't, but that does. And they also have a really good foundation in terms of, you know, how they've managed their money in the past. And so they're not hurting. And so the advice was, look, there's other relief out there for you. Certifying, especially because housing allowance is not included in this calculation, the difference between doing the payroll tax credit that we talked about earlier and doing the PPP, once you pulled the minister's self-employment earnings out. Wasn't that huge? And it avoided them having to checkmark something that really wasn't true, right? So do try to just be honest when you're applying for these. There are other programs out there that are available for different situations. And if you don't need the PPP, then don't apply for it. If you don't need the EIDL, don't apply for it. There are other people out there who need it. That said, if you are affected, you should apply. These programs are out there for a reason. So
great. So that was all of our questions
great.
For today.
I am so, so glad that we did this. I'm so glad that we did a follow-up. That's
thank
wonderful.
You so much. I'm going to go ahead. So thank you so much for being here. I'm just going to end this because I end every call this way. Dream big, shine bright, and be kind.